I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Robert Gordon. He's producer and director of the film Best of Enemies, which screens at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. And he will be doing this Sunday, the 23rd, a live Skype Q&A after the 2:30 screening, but it's screening all week. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
So this is a film about Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley Jr., who changed the nature of television, particularly television coverage of national politics, when they were hired by the network ABC in 1968 to debate each other during the Republican National Convention. How did the pairing of these two really arch enemies come to be?
Well, in 1968, there were three networks. We're in a media scape now with hundreds of networks, and then there were only three. And ABC was a distant third. It would have been fourth, but there were only three, as someone in the film says. Since TV had come in, the networks have been covering conventions gavel to gavel, from the beginning to the end, and if they had a floor fight, they'd hang on to it late at night. But ABC realized in 68 it really needed the income from its primetime programming, Batman, The Flying Nun, FBI, that kind of thing, Land of the Giants. So they decided to do what they called unconventional convention coverage. And they were going to do an hour and a half synopsis with color commentary. And one-fifth of that evening, each evening, was going to be Gore Vidal and William Buckley, who were supposed to really focus on the events of the day at the convention, but who found each other's politics, beliefs, and lifestyles so dangerous for the future of the nation that they really just kind of attacked each other.
Yeah, I mean, that was what was so striking. They were a lot more involved with attacking each other. I mean, there's a hatred that's palpable in their debates. And there were some issues that they talked about a little bit, but it was more of these attacks. How did that go over with the TV viewers?
Well, in 1968, it was mixed. The interesting thing that happened was that they tripled their ratings of the previous convention coverage, but they also got complaints that these guys wouldn't get to the subject of the day. I think we have the benefit of hindsight here, and we could see that in 1968, what we call now identity politics was being formed. And each of these two men embodied the antithetical approach to the republic from the other. So that's why they found each other dangerous. So there, and this is really where the personal becomes political. By attacking each other, they're attacking those positions. Gore is a gay pansexualist. Buckley is a conservative, you know, who's a spokesman for corporations and against entitlement programs. So they're each thought the other's views could take down the nation. And they really came to this loaded for bear to take the other down. They'd had several previous encounters, so ABC knew there were going to be sparks. I don't think they anticipated quite the forest fire that they got.
You know, it's funny, too, because they were both wealthy, upper-class intellectuals, prolific, politically engaged writers, and yet there was no common ground between them or their followers. Talk for a moment about who their followers were. What groups followed and loved each man?
Well, the interesting thing is that unlike spokespeople today, neither particularly embraced the whole of either party's platform. Buckley was there as a conservative, not as a Republican, and Vidal was there as a liberal, not as a Democrat. And each was willing to attack the positions of their own respective party to the extent that they didn't agree with them. so their followers, I mean, Buckley had come in the 50s. He had sort of come in from the outside with this book, God and Man at Yale, and begun to coalesce a force to pull the Republican Party to his way of thinking. So from 55 really to 1980, when Reagan was elected, he was working to change conservative thought and move the mainstream his way, which he achieved. You know, when Reagan was elected, that was the apogee of Bill's work. When he came in, the conservative movement was the John Birch Society, what he called the kooks and the anti-Semites. And so he was a guy giving intellectual rigor to a stream of thought that had been kind of Paleolithic. And Vidal was not a joiner. He didn't really, he wasn't trying to, actually in Chicago at the Democratic convention in 68, he's running around trying to form a fourth party. You know, the third party that year was George Wallace's racist platform, and Vidal was trying to actually form a fourth party. Someone said to him, let's see, I don't have the quote at my fingertips, but someone was asking him about forming a third party at one point, and he said, I didn't yet know there was a second one. He, through his novels, and in 68, Myra Breckinridge was his breakthrough popular seller about a man who becomes a woman who becomes a man, you know, very timely today. He was just sort of blowing people's minds with its possibility, and people were following him, though he didn't aspire to lead.
Yeah, it's interesting how prescient he was in many ways. I mean, he talks about the Vietnam War, he talks about wealth inequality, and there's this moment which is kind of poignant in retrospect where Gore Vidal says, you know, the top 5% of Americans own 20% of the wealth and the bottom 20% only own 5% of the wealth. And, you know, now that seems like the good old days where the, you know, today the 1% is owning something like half the wealth.
Yeah.
Do you think he foresaw the direction that this country has ended up in with this much, much more severe inequality?
Well, I don't know whether, you know, he foresaw that, but he certainly foresaw the some other issues. He foresaw the dangers of American empire in particular. I know I got into this when I saw a bootlegged DVD of the Raw debates, and I was so struck by, at that time, that was 2010, we were in Afghanistan and Iraq, and everything he said about Vietnam, and he extrapolated to be about empire, and it was so true in the present, as it remains today. He was seeing, you know, I don't know if anybody could foresee the drastic changes in financial equity that have arisen, but he was already very strong on entitlements and on ways to strike out against poverty. And it's taken 50 years, really, for his ideas to become mainstream. You know, I think that's an interesting thing. There was a debate winner, but then in the following 12 to 20 years, Buckley's ideas were really dominant in America, and Buckley lived to see his ideas evaporate. He lived to see the Tea Party arise and the lack of intellectual rigor on the Republican side come back, and that had to be devastating for him. And Vidal lived to see the beginning of his ideas go mainstream. So we see the two sides of the pendulum and the wide swing it takes.
Who actually won the debate?
Well, there's 10 debates, five in Miami Beach and five in Chicago. And in the penultimate debate, on a night in Chicago where there'd been rioting in the parks and police beatings of protesters, and they showed this clip in the ninth, right prior to the ninth debate, and it began with commentary on that. So there was this sense of the two men actually, and Buckley defended the police and Vidal defended the rioters or the protesters. And there was this sense of each of them, and there was talk of civil war. You know, we have to remember, in 1968, the nation was really coming apart, propelled that chasm widening because of the draft in Vietnam. So this penultimate debate gets more and more tense. I believe that they each had tear gas in their eyes from the walk over to the TV studio. They get into it. Howard K. Smith, the moderator, compares raising the Viet Cong flag in Grant Park to raising a Nazi flag during World War II. So he puts the word Nazi into play. And in the course of the debate, Buckley interrupts Vidal a number of times. Vidal says, "Shut up a minute." Buckley won't, and refers again to the Nazis. And Vidal says, "The only pro or crypto-Nazi I can think of here is yourself." And Howard K. Smith says, "Let's not call names, but it's too late." And Buckley, in this fit of rage, leans toward Vidal and says, "Now, listen, you queer, stop calling me a crypto-Nazi or I'll sock you in the goddamn face and you'll stay plastered." It's a threat of violence. And the way he lost his cool was basically a forfeit of the debates. So Buckley lost the debate, but even more importantly to him, he lost his cool in a very public manner, which he had been the master of not doing, and thereafter was the master of not doing. It was a real break in character for him and haunted him all his life.
It really did, and it's very affecting to see that moment where he loses cool like that, because he'd always been Mr. sort of frosty, above it all, intellectual kind of guy. And that led to years of animosity, long articles back and forth in Esquire magazine and other places, and even lawsuits. How did that play out with the people? I mean, what was the effect on the public of this ongoing animosity?
Well, the effect on the public really came more from what the networks took away from the ratings of these debates. Because ABC did so surprisingly well, two things happened. One, the other networks had ridiculed ABC for their lack of gavel-to-gavel coverage. No one ever did gavel-to-gavel coverage again, except perhaps for C-SPAN. And more importantly, network executives realized that fireworks sells, that they can get ratings through incivility. And I think what we've seen, what we saw over the next 30 years, and then from, you know, the turn of the century to the present, is this scientifically engineered television discourse that gives the most shouting between the commercials that a network can get. That's their goal. And what we've forsaken is the content, and what we've forsaken is the original thinkers, like these two guys. Instead, we have party shills who come on and deliver the talking points. You don't even need to have the volume on anymore. You can watch it on mute. If you know the weekly talking points, you know what will be said. So I think that's been the effect, this attention to fireworks without the content.
Which is profoundly ironic, because as you say in the beginning of the film, at that time, TV news was the most trusted institution in the United States.
Yeah.
And so here we have this network who says, okay, TV news, we're going to bring these two thinkers on, and whatever you might think of either one, they were both very serious writers and thinkers and authors and so on. They weren't just talking point pundits, as you point out. And that kind of debate, because of the animosity, not because of the intellectual rigor of either one, led to a situation where nobody trusts TV news anymore.
Yes, 68, such a fascinating year. It's really a year where the downfall begins. You can't discount the impact of Watergate in 72 for this sense of distrust. No longer could we trust the government. And what's interesting, I think, though, is the double-edged sword of the change in journalism. When it was this most trusted institution through the 60s, it was basically, you know, a group of white-haired white males sitting in a skyscraper in New York determining this is the news. The benefit was that we all shared the same, there was a public square. We all shared the same news. And so people could argue about the same facts. And in this age of the internet, we have this great democratization of the news. You can be in Tahrir Square, you can be in Ferguson, you can be in Syria, and you can post footage and deliver news to the world. And that's an incredibly powerful thing. But the other side of that is that you can create a website and post news on it, and it's not true. You can create falsehoods, present it as fact, and your search engine is finding the words, you know, but it's not checking the facts. And we find ourselves like in the pages of a George Orwell novel, where we no longer share the, you know, there's that old saying, everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but we all have to share the same set of facts. And suddenly we find ourselves not sharing the same set of facts, and I think there's a lot of danger in that.
We're talking about the film Best of Enemies with director and producer Robert Gordon, and I wondered if you could talk about each man, William F. Buckley and Gore Vidal, and what you think the legacy of each one has been over the years, since 1968 and through the present. I mean, I'm not sure how many, for example, college students today have heard of either one, but they both do have significant legacies.
Yes. And before I answer that, I just want to say, because I realize, you know, we're having a very weighty conversation, but the thing we forget about public intellectuals like these two guys were is that they're really funny. And so, yeah. You know, it's been really, really rewarding to us to sit in audiences when this film plays and to absorb the laughter. You know, people, it's like riotously funny until it turns until the despair sets in. But I just want to point out that, you know, this isn't a film with a lot of polemic. It is a film with a lot of laughs, and it gets quite disturbing. And so the legacy of these guys, well, you know, Buckley's notions, it's funny, when I began this in 2010, the woman who was my editor at the time, who stayed on and was editor of this film, she was probably in her early 30s, and so I'd seen this footage, and the next time we were editing, I said, hey, I got this new idea, I think it's going to be great, it's about these debates between William Buckley and Gore Vidal, and her face was totally blank. I was like, okay, cool. That tells me that lots of people in the U.S. don't know who these people are, and we got to include, you know, biography. I was shocked, you know, because I was raised with libraries full of the spines of Gore Vidal's thick books, and I was raised with William Buckley's firing line program being, you know, the better alternative to the Sunday morning preachers. So these guys were part of my life, my whole life. So there's a lot of biography in the movie. And as for their legacies, I think, you know, Bill Buckley really did created a conservative that we long for today. Ronald Reagan and his policies are somewhat divisive, or as divisive as they are. Buckley, the man behind a lot of those policies, was a conservative willing to engage in actual dialogue to try to change minds, and was willing to change his own mind in public, which I think is extremely admirable, on race, on war. You know, all his life he was, if he realized that, if he changed his mind, he wasn't afraid to do it in public. So I think he's the kind of conservative that we long for now. And Vidal is the kind of well-rounded liberal, again, willing to engage. He was less inclined to change his mind in public, Vidal was. It's interesting, you know, in that regard to see that it's taken 50 years for his ideas to go mainstream. But I think we're seeing a lot of his sort of libertarian ideas. It's funny because they're both, in a way, kind of libertarian. They want to allow people to do what they want, whether it's, you know, be a man who becomes a woman who becomes a man, or whether it's whatever Buckley's conservative notions were. So, yeah, I think we live with their ideas. They've sort of been absorbed into our everyday culture, even as their names have diminished in recognition.
The film also really, I think, invites an interesting discussion on what debate is. Because, I mean, debate, when we look at presidential debates, I don't know when there was last an actual debate, according to anything that in high school might be called debate, where you actually, you know, make points and rebut those points and so on. But, I mean, in this film, we see something that isn't so much the kind of debate that one wishes to see, because what you want to see is people really listening to each other and really getting to the root of why we disagree and what we disagree on. I mean, do we disagree on poverty is a bad thing and America needs to be fixed? We might disagree on, if we agree on that, how it should be fixed. We might disagree on what does and doesn't work. But there's such a longing, I think, for actual substantial dialogue, which they didn't have and which we don't have almost anywhere anymore.
Well, I disagree to some extent, because I think that in their exchange, they're bringing, I mean, when was the last time anyone quoted Pericles on national TV? I think that these guys had the command of so much education. They had the classics, economics, language, that they could bring to bear all of their education on their comments, even if they were dissing each other. You know, when Vidal calls Buckley the Marie Antoinette of the right wing, that's, you know, that requires you to know a little bit of history to get the joke. And I think that they understood, too, at the time, that the audience, with three networks, you were not preaching to the choir. Fox wasn't preaching to the Fox News choir. You know, MSNBC wasn't preaching to their thinkers. You had a broader audience. So I think that there is more. I think what maybe stays with you is the insults, because they're so engaging. But, you know, they are from that first debate discussing issues of economics. You were citing some earlier from one of the later debates. Again, I think it's that the networks, the present-day networks, have sort of scientifically engineered the insults to be the foreground, whereas they had a lot more heft to their back and forth.
Yeah. Well, the film is called Best of Enemies. It is screening at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe, and Robert Gordon, producer and director of the film, will be with us by Skype this Sunday, the 23rd of August, after the 2:30 screening, so people can go to that and participate in this question-and-answer session. Robert Gordon, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Okay, thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.